Chapter 6. Sheriff James Egan, Jr. was directing the rescue operation at the Pandora Mine when he received the call from his dispatcher informing him that Luis Marquez was being held in custody by the Telluride Town Marshal's deputies at the new Sheridan Hotel for breaking and entering. Egan was incredulous. How was this possible? Marquez's wife had been adamant in claiming her husband and two others were trapped inside the mine by the avalanche. Against his better judgment, Egan turned over command of the rescue operation and drove down the mountain to the hotel. The last thing he expected to find was a mangled motorcycle sitting amid several cases of smashed bottles of wine. His astonishment broadened when he stepped into the hotel's conference room to confront the confessed culprits and found three damp, dirty, and bedraggled people, two men and one woman, one of them wearing a torn and tattered diver's wetsuit. All were in handcuffs and in the custody of two deputy marshals who stood with solemn expressions on their faces. One of them nodded at Pitt.
"This one was carrying an arsenal."
"You have his weapons?" Egan asked officially. The deputy nodded and held up three para-ordnance 45 caliber automatics. Satisfied, Egan turned his attention to Luis Marquez.
"How in hell did you get out of the mine and wind up here?" he demanded in complete bewilderment.
"It doesn't matter," Marquez snapped back. "You and your deputies have got to go down the tunnel. You'll find two dead bodies and a college professor, Dr. Ambrose, who we left guarding a killer." There was a genuine feeling of skepticism, almost total disbelief, in Sheriff Jim Egan's mind as he sat down, tipped his chair back on two legs, and pulled a notebook from the breast pocket of his shirt.
"Suppose you tell me just what is going on here."
Desperately, Marquez gave a brief account of the cave-in and flooding, Pitt's fortuitous appearance, their escape from the mysterious chamber, the encounter with the three murderers, and their forced entry into the wine cellar of the hotel. At first, the details came slowly, as Marquez fought off the effects of strain and exhaustion. Then his words flowed faster as he sensed Egan's obvious doubt. Frustration swelled and was replaced by urgency as Marquez pleaded with Egan to rescue Tom Ambrose.
"Damn it, Jim, stop being stubborn. Get off your butt and go see for yourself."
Egan knew Marquez and respected him as a man of integrity, but his story was too far-fetched to buy without proof.
"Black obsidian skulls, indecipherable writings in a chamber carved 1,000 feet into the mountain, murderers roaming mineshafts on motorcycles. If what you tell me is true, it will be the three of you who will be under suspicion for murder."
"Mr. Marquez has told you the honest truth," said Pat slowly, speaking for the first time. "Why can't you believe him?"
"And you are?"
"Patricia O'Connell," she said wearily. "I'm with the University of Pennsylvania."
"And what is your reason for being in the mine?"
"My field is ancient languages. I was asked to come to Telluride and decipher the strange inscriptions Mr. Marquez found in his mine."
Egan studied the woman for a moment. She might have been pretty when attractively dressed and made up. He did not find it easy to believe she was a Ph.D. in ancient languages. Sitting there with her wet, stringy hair and mud-smeared face, she looked like a homeless bag lady.
"All I know for sure," said Egan slowly, "is that you people destroyed a motorcycle, which might be stolen, and vandalized the wine cellar of the hotel."
"Forget that," pleaded Marquez. "Rescue Dr. Ambrose."
"Only when I'm sure of the facts will I send my men into the mine."
Jim Egan had been sheriff of San Miguel County for 8 years and worked in harmony with the marshals who policed the town of Telluride. Homicides were few and far between in San Miguel County. Law enforcement problems usually centered around auto accidents, petty theft, drunken fights, vandalism, and drug arrests, usually involving young transients who passed through Telluride during the summer season and attended various affairs such as the bluegrass and jazz festivals. Egan was respected by the citizens of his small but beautifully scenic domain.
He was a congenial man, serious in his work, but quick to laugh when having a beer at one of the local watering holes. Of medium height and weight, he often wore a facial expression that could berate and intimidate. One look was generally all it took to cower any suspects he had arrested. "May I ask you a small favor?" said the bruised and fatigued man in the torn diver's wetsuit, who looked as though he had been dragged through the impellers of a water pump. At first glance, he looked to Egan to be 45, but he was probably a good 5 years younger than the tanned and craggy face suggested. The sheriff guessed him to be about 6 feet 3 inches, weight 185 pounds, give or take. His hair was black and wavy, with a few strands of gray at the temples. The eyebrows were dark and bushy, and stretched over eyes that wore a vivid green. A straight and narrow nose dropped toward firm lips, with the corners turned up in a slight grin. What bothered Egan wasn't so much the man's indifferent attitude, he'd known many felons who displayed apathy, but his bemused kind of detached interest. It was obvious that the man across the table was not the least bit impressed with Egan's dominating tactics.
"Depends," Egan answered finally, his ballpoint pen poised above a page in the notebook. "Your name?"
"Dirk Pitt."
"And what is your involvement, Mr. Pitt?"
"I'm Special Projects Director for the National Underwater and Marine Agency. I was just passing by and thought it might be fun to prospect for gold."
Inwardly, Egan seethed at being at a disadvantage. "We can do without the humor, Mr. Pitt."
"If I give you a phone number, will you do me the courtesy of calling it?"
Pitt's tone was polite, with no trace of hostility.
"You want to speak to an attorney?"
Pitt shook his head.
"No, nothing like that. I thought a simple call to confirm my position and presence might be helpful."
Egan thought a moment, then passed his pen and notebook across the table.
"Okay, let's have the number."
Pitt wrote it in the sheriff's notebook and handed it back.
"It's long distance. You can call collect if you wish."
"You can pay the hotel," Egan said with a tight smile.
"You'll be talking to Admiral James Sandecker," said Pitt. "The number is his private line. Give him my name and explain the situation."
Egan moved to a phone on a nearby desk, asked for an outside line, and dialed the number. After a brief pause, Egan said,
"Admiral Sandecker, this is Sheriff Jim Egan of San Miguel County, Colorado. I have a problem here concerning a man who claims to work for you. His name is Dirk Pitt."
Then Egan quickly outlined the situation, stating that Pitt would probably be placed under arrest and charged with second-degree criminal trespass, theft, and vandalism. From that point on, the conversation went downhill as his face took on a dazed expression that lasted nearly 10 minutes. As if talking to God, he repeated,
"Yes, sir," several times.
Finally, he hung up and stared at Pitt.
"Your boss is a testy bastard."
Pitt laughed.
"He strikes most people that way."
"You have a most impressive history."
"Did he offer to pay for damages?"
Egan grinned.
"He insisted it come out of your salary."
Curious, Pat asked,
"What else did the Admiral have to say?"
"He said, among other things," Egan spoke slowly, "that if Mr. Pitt claimed the South won the Civil War, I was to believe him."
Pitt and Marquez, with Egan and one of his deputies trailing behind, stepped through the shattered wall of the wine cellar and began jogging through the old mine tunnel. They soon passed the old stationary ore car and continued into the yawning tube. There was no way for Pitt to judge distance in the darkened bore. His best guess was that he had left Ambrose and the captured assassin approximately 3/4 of a mile from the hotel. He held a flashlight borrowed from a deputy and switched it off every few hundred feet, peering into the darkness ahead for a sign from the dive light he'd left with Ambrose. After covering what he believed was the correct distance,
Pitt stopped and aimed the beam of the flashlight as far up the tunnel as it would penetrate. Then he flicked it off. Only pitch blackness stretched ahead.
"We're there," Pitt said to Marquez.
"That's impossible," said the miner. "Dr. Ambrose would have heard our voices echoing off the rock and seen our lights. He would have shouted or signaled us."
"Something isn't right."
Pitt threw the flashlight's beam at an opening in one wall of the tunnel. "There's the portal to the bore I hid in when the bikers approached."
Egan came up beside him.
"Why are we stopping?"
"Crazy as it sounds," Pitt answered, "they've vanished."
The sheriff shone his light in Pitt's face, searching for something in his eyes.
"You sure they weren't a figment of your imagination?"
"I swear to God," Marquez muttered, "we left two dead bodies, an unconscious killer and Dr. Ambrose with a gun to cover him."
Pitt ignored the sheriff and dropped to his knees.
He swept his light around the tunnel very slowly in a 180-degree arc, his eyes examining every inch of the ground and the ore car tracks. Marquez started to say, "What are you?" But Pitt threw up one hand, motioning him to silence. In Pitt's mind, if Ambrose and the killer were gone, they had to have left some tiny indication of their presence. His original intent had been to look for the shell casings ejected from the P-10 automatic he'd used to shoot the killers. But there was no hint of a gleam from the brass casings. The back of his neck began to tingle. This was the right spot, he was certain of it. Then he sensed, rather than saw, an almost infinitesimal strand of black wire, no more than 18 inches away, so thin it didn't cast a shadow under his light. He trailed the beam along the wire, over the rail tracks, and up the wall to a black canvas bundle attached to one of the overhead timbers.
"Tell me, Sheriff," Pitt said in a strangely quiet voice, "have you had bomb disposal training?"
"I teach a course in it to law enforcement," Egan replied, eyebrows raised. "I was a demolitions expert in the Army. Why ask?"
"I do believe we were set up to enter the next world in pieces."
He pointed to the wire leading from the tracks and up the timber.
"Unless I miss my guess, that's an explosive booby trap."
Egan moved until his face was inches away from the black strand. He followed it up to the canvas bundle and studied the bundle carefully. Then he turned to Pitt with a new level of respect in his eyes.
"I do believe you are right, Mr. Pitt. Somebody doesn't like you."
"Include yourself, Sheriff. They must have known you and your men would have accompanied us back to Dr. Ambrose."
"Where is the professor?" wondered Marquez aloud. "Where did he and the killer go?"
"There are two possibilities," said Pitt. "The first is that the killer regained consciousness, overpowered Doc Ambrose, killed him, and dumped his body down the nearest mineshaft. Then he placed the charge and escaped through another tunnel leading to the outside."
"You should write fairy tales," said Egan.
"Then explain the booby trap."
"How do I know you didn't set it?"
"I have no motive."
"Get off it, Jim," said Marquez. "Mr. Pitt hasn't been out of my sight for the past 5 hours. He just saved our lives. If the blast didn't get us, the cave-in would."
"We're not certain the bundle contains explosives," Egan said stubbornly.
"Then trip the wire and see what happens."
Pitt grinned.
"I, for one, am not going to hang around and find out. I'm out of here."
He rose to his feet and began strolling along the ore car tracks back to the hotel.
"One moment, Mr. Pitt. I'm not through with you."
Pitt paused and turned.
"What are your intentions, Sheriff?"
"Check out the sack wired to the timber, and if it's an explosive device, disarm it."
Pitt took a few steps back, his face dead serious.
"I wouldn't if I were you. That's not some bomb built in the backyard of a junior terrorist. I'll bet my next paycheck it was exactingly assembled by experts and will burst at the slightest touch.
Egan looked at him.
If you have a better idea, I'd like to hear it.
The ore car sitting a couple of hundred yards up the track, replied Pitt.
We give it a shove and let it roll through here and trip the wire and detonate the explosives.
The roof of the tunnel will collapse, said Marquez, blocking it forever.
Pitt shrugged.
It's not like we're destroying the tunnel to deny access to future generations. We're the first to have passed through this section of the mine since the 1930s.
Makes sense, Egan finally agreed. We can't leave explosives laying about for the next underground explorers who walk through here.
15 minutes later, Pitt, Egan, Marquez, and the deputy had pushed the ore car to within 50 yards of the tripwire. The heavy iron wheels squeaked and protested for the first 50 feet, but soon loosened, and began to roll smoothly over the rusty rails as the ancient grease on their axles lubricated the roller bearings. The four sweating men finally reached the crest of a slight slope that led downward.
The end of the line, Pitt announced. One good shove and she should roll for a mile.
Or until she drops into the next shaft, said Marquez. The men heaved in unison and ran with the car, propelling it until it picked up speed and began to outrace them. They staggered to a halt and caught their breath, allowing their pounding hearts to slow. Then they held their flashlights on the ore car as it charged over the rails and disappeared around a gradual curve of the tunnel. Less than a minute later, a tremendous detonation tore through the tunnel. The shockwave nearly knocked them off their feet. Then came a cloud of dust that swirled around and past them, followed by the deep rumble of tons of rock falling from the roof of the tunnel. The rumble was still ringing in their ears, the echoes reverberating in the old mine, when Marquez shouted to Egan,
"That should stifle any doubts."
"In your haste to prove your point, you overlooked something," Egan said loudly, his tone dry and provocative. Pitt looked at him.
"Which is?"
"Dr. Ambrose. He could still be alive somewhere beyond the cave-in. And even if he's dead, there will be no way of retrieving his body."
"It'll be a wasted effort," Pitt said briefly.
"You only gave us one possibility," said Egan. "Does this have something to do with the second?"
Pitt gave a slight nod.
"Dr. Ambrose," he said patiently, "is not dead."
"Are you saying the third assassin didn't kill him?" asked Marquez.
"He'd hardly murder his own boss."
"Boss?"
Pitt smiled and said firmly, "Dr. Tom Ambrose was one of the killers."